Welcome to Kevin JJ's Movie Mania Podcast, where Kevin and JJ discuss everything and anything they can about the movies they love and sometimes about the movies they hate. On this week's episode, JJ and I tackle a new top five list. We've decided to forego the on-the-spot aspect of it so we can have a more thorough and interesting conversation about our picks. So sit back and relax, and we hope you enjoy. Hey, everybody. So we decided to get rid of the on-the-spot aspect of our top five list. So, you know, we'll have a chance to talk more informatively about all our picks and things like that. So, this week, the top five list that I chose is the top five movies with multiple roles or multiple performances by one of its actors. So, I'm going to turn it over to JJ to start things out.
Hello. Number five on my list, it's going to be pretty populist pick, as is what I normally go towards. That's what I gravitate towards, it seems. It is from one of the iconic movies of all time, and it's going to be from 1939's Wizard of Oz. And actually, there are several actors in this movie that play multiple roles, but I'm just going to hone in on the major one, which would be Margaret Hamilton's The Wicked Witch of the West.
Oh, yeah.
I want to see you and your wife right away about Dorothy.
Dorothy? Well, what has Dorothy done?
What's she done? I'm all but lame from the bite on my leg.
Me, she bit you?
No, her dog.
Oh, she bit her dog, eh?
No. That dog's a menace to the community. I'm taking him to the sheriff and make sure he's destroyed.
Destroyed? Toto? Oh, you can't. You mustn't. Addie M., Uncle Henry, you won't let her, will you?
Of course we won't. Where are we in?
Please, Aunt Em. Toto didn't mean to. He didn't know he was doing anything wrong. I'm the one that ought to be punished. I let him go in her garden. You can send me to bed without supper.
If you don't hand over that dog, I'll bring a damn suit that'll take your whole farm. There's a law protecting folks against dogs that bite. How would it be if she keeps him tied up? He's really gentle. With gentle people, that is.
Well, that's for the sheriff to decide. Here's his order. Allow me to take it. If you want to go against the law.
And we can't go against the law, Dorothy. I'm afraid poor Toto will have to go.
Now you're seeing reason. Here's what I'm taking him in. So he can't attack me again.
Oh, no, no, I won't let you take him. You go away. Oh, I'll fight you myself.
Dorothy.
You wicked old witch. Uncle Henry, Annie, don't let him take you.
No,
don't let him take you. No, please, stop.
Put him in the basket, Henry.
Oh, yeah, I did.
No. Oh, no.
Elmira Gulch. Just because you own half the county doesn't mean you have the power to run the rest of us. For 23 years, I've been dying to tell you what I thought of you. And now, well, being a Christian woman, I can't say it.
And, you know, when we first see the actress, it's, you know, in the first 15 or 20 minutes, she's playing the cranky, cantankerous next-door neighbor, Elmira Gulch.
And popping up on that bike, it's one of the greatest introductions in
exactly.
Film history.
Exactly. And, you know, no disrespect to Margaret Hamilton, but, you know, that was a fairly unattractive woman. So
yeah, she wasn't cast for her looks.
No. Or maybe she was.
Well, yeah, for her good looks.
Right. She, you know, kind of with her more, like, erect posture, her, you know, her outfit, her face, her nose, her hair pulled back, just, you know, miserable. You see her coming, you want to run the other way. And here she is hating on Dorothy's dog, hating on Dorothy, basically bullying herself into the house. And, you know, intimidating Aunt Em and Uncle, whatever his name was, I can't remember the moment. And then to see her drive away, like you said, on her bike, and later on to be the Wicked Witch of the West on her broomstick, and just completely, like, she plays evil twice, but they're two, like, completely different type of evils.
Absolutely. I mean, when she first shows up on the bike, it's an instant recognition that this is a villain.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the music helps in that scene, but, you know, the moment you see her, she's evil. But then the moment you see her in Oz, it's just ramped up. Even it's in a...
The fantasy level. Now it becomes fantasy.
Exactly.
Everything is
comic.
Amplified.
You know, it's so over the top with the quintessential, you know, black hat, the green skin, and all that kind of stuff. It becomes almost comical.
Yep. And, you know, yeah, she has the prosthetic nose on and the green makeup, but, you know, you still know it's her.
Oh, yeah.
At least, you know, I did. I kind of put two and two together. It's the same actress playing both. And, yeah, she definitely sprung to my mind when thinking about this list. So that would be my number five.
No, that's a good one.
Thank you.
All right. So my number five, and once again, I'm going to preempt everything we say from here on in with a spoiler alert.
Right.
Because some of them you kind of have to discuss major plot points in the movie to explain the performances and things.
Okay.
So my number five is, actually, before I say, let me make sure I have the year right.
I'm like anticipating what you're going to say. Right.
It's from 2009. And it's Duncan Jones's Moon.
2 weeks to go, Sam.
2 weeks to go, buddy.
I'm going home.
Looks like we got a live one. I'm gonna go out.
Okay, Sam.
Leaving Sarang working perimeter.
Who is he? You tell me who that is!
Perhaps you're imagining things.
What's going on?
Where did he come from? Why does he look like me?
You've been up here too long, man. You've lost your marbles.
2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks.
I don't understand what's happening. This is my mind. Go home.
I know.
Oh.
I love good sci-fi movies.
Sure.
Some of them are way too over the top and silly. What Duncan Jones did with Moon with Sam Rockwell is just fantastic. It's, you know, comparatively on a shoestring budget and is basically one actor playing two roles and eventually even more. But the Sam Bell and, like, you know, Sam Bell 1 and Sam Bell 2, they're so different. Like, one is so tired and beaten, one is spry and excited to do his work, and whenever one of, you know, Sam Rockwell plays them so similar yet so distinct, you never are questioning which one you are interacting with on screen.
Right.
Whether or not it's the Sam Bell who's leaving in 2 weeks, or if it's the Sam Bell that just woke up. It's exactly what makes that movie exciting is watching Sam
Rockwell.
Yeah,
it's what makes it work.
Yeah,
it's what makes it work, because
not only is it what makes it work, it's what the movie is.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what I was
going
to say.
I mean, it's sheerly about Sam Rockwell interacting with Sam Rockwell, and to be able to handle that for, you know, 2 hours of a sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
In isolation on the moon, That's yep. A pretty great accomplishment by a very rookie director.
That's what I was going to say. It's not a gimmick. It's a rookie director, so there's nothing, you know, there's nothing gimmicky. It's a claustrophobic type of movie, which is great about it. It's just you, the audience member, in this kind of closed-off space with the two Sam Rockwells. Like you said, they're distinct, but they're different. I remember the music kind of aiding the story a lot, very good music. Yep. And Sam Rockwell, so versatile. He was amazing in that movie. I can't believe I didn't even think about that movie or that performance when you mentioned him. I was right. Kind of like, aha, of course, when you said it off your lips. I was like, yeah, that's a great performance.
Yeah, and I love the – I always like the dynamic in a movie where – the mystery that the character has is what the audience shares with him.
Yeah.
You know,
definitely.
Sam Bell 1 is just as clueless and confused and frustrated as the audience is when they see Sam Bell 2 walking around. They're like, you know, you're sitting there like, well, what can explain this? This is it time travel? Is it, you know, you have no idea, and it just little clues unfold and fold and fold, and it makes it very, very exciting.
I agree. You're right. It's almost like, you know, the armchair experience we have, or like the fly on the wall.
Right.
We're learning as he or they are learning, and you're right. That's a great, great aspect of it.
Yep. So that's my five.
Okay, so my number four on the list is, again, shocker of all shocks, a populist pick. And it would be from 1964's Mary Poppins.
Okay.
And it would be Mr. Dick Van Dyke as Bert, the kind of cockney, jack-of-all-trades, you know, sidewalk painter. And also later in the movie, he plays the banker, Mr. Dawes Sr.
Right.
And, you know, Mary Poppins, it's one of those movies, growing up as a kid, I watched ad nauseum for whatever reason, whenever it was on TV, or my parents taped it, and I watched it. And, you know, it's... And Dick Van Dyke, who, funny enough, you learn from watching Saving Mr. Banks last year that came out, that... you know, he was definitely not the first person in mind for the role of Bert. And what he was able to do was make it his own, make it an iconic performance, number one, as Bert, who, you know, Dick Van Dyke, he's an American, and he puts on this kind of overemphasized, over-the-top Cockney accent.
It's one of the, considered one of the worst movie accents in history, but...
Yet, as a kid,
it kind of works.
It does in its own kind of family fun film way.
Right.
I also think, I mean, if you think about it, it's probably also easier to inflect a Cockney accent rather than, you know, because it's so overemphasized. You can get away with like a British accent when you do Cockney because it's just so ridiculous.
Right. I mean, a Cockney accent in real life is overemphasized. Like, I mean, it's just such a difficult, you know, accent to understand, and it's so harsh as it, you know, the fact that any American sounded ridiculous doing it is kind of expected.
Yes. And so, yeah, I mean, he's basically our narrator, you know, taking us through the streets of this very upper middle class neighborhood, and he winds up being a good friend and possible love interest of Mary Poppins. And he's just this very sprightly, you know, lively, animated, both, you know, with his voice and with his physicality, just such like a great character. And he can do that, and then later in the movie, buried under old age makeup and wigs and, you know, an elderly gentleman's bank attire with this kind of stooped, bent over with a cane, wobbling and wobbling and wobbling around, you know, able to be this probably 90-year-old banker.
Right.
You know, it's just a polar opposite. It's still animated in its own way. It's just a completely different form of animated character. And, you know, you don't really know it's him. You don't know it's him
automatically. Right, and it's surprising because it doesn't have to be him in no sense of the word. He chose to do it, I guess, to do something different because Dick Van Dyke is so talented. Mm-hmm. But it certainly
I don't think anybody really knew the depth of his talent until he was cast in this. And then, maybe he wasn't initially supposed to be playing Mr. Dawes. And then they were like, hey, this guy can do it.
What the hell?
Right. And he puts on a completely different voice inflection. You know, I guess it's some sort of British, but it's old, bumbling old man, you know, barely croaking out his words and stuttering over himself. And it sprung to my mind. Mary Poppins, Dick Van Dyke.
All right. Good pick.
Thank you.
I'll move on to my number four. It's also a rather decently modern movie.
Okay.
It's from 2002, and it is Adaptation.
As soon as she said 2002, I knew it.
Yep.
What? You want to hear my pitch? Go away, goddammit. You know, I'm just trying to do something. Hey, thanks a lot, buddy. Cool. Okay, there's a serial killer, right? Well, no, wait. And he's being hunted by a cop. And he's taunting the cop, right? Sending clues who his next victim is. He's already holding her hostage in his creepy basement. So the cop gets obsessed with figuring out her identity and in the process falls in love with her. Even though he's never even met her. She becomes like the unattainable, like the Holy Grail.
It's a little obvious, don't you think?
Okay, but here's the twist. We find out that the killer really suffers from multiple personality disorder, right? See, he's actually really the cop and the girl. All of them are him. Isn't that fucked up?
The only idea more overused than serial killers is multiple personality. On top of that, you explore the notion that cop and criminal are really two aspects of the same person. See every cop movie ever made for other examples of this.
Mom called it psychologically taught. The other thing is, there's no way to write this. Did you consider that? I mean, how could you have somebody held prisoner in a basement and working in a police station at the same time?
Trick photography.
Okay, that's not what I'm asking. Listen closely. What I'm asking is, in the reality of this movie, where there's only one character, right? Okay? How could you... What exactly would... I agree with Mom. Very taut. Sybil meets, I don't know, Dress to Kill.
Cool. I really like Dress to Kill. Until the third act denouement.
That's not how it's pronounced.
You know, in recent days, or recent years, I should say, you know, Nicolas Cage has become pretty much a joke.
Yeah.
But in the late 90s to, like, the mid-2000s, like, you couldn't get better than him.
Yeah.
He was so good in everything he did.
Mm-hmm.
And Adaptation is one of the strangest movies and hardest movies to explain to somebody. But the way he plays Charlie Kaufman, who's a screenwriter, he fictionally plays Charlie Kaufman, but then he also plays Donald Kaufman, his fictional twin. Once again, just like my previous pick, these two characters are, you know, they're twins, so they look exactly like Nicolas Cage in both ways, but Nicolas Cage performs them so differently.
Yes.
That you're never confused, and they're so polar opposite that they like ignite when they're on screen together.
Mm-hmm.
They're
polar opposite, but they're also both heartbreaking in different ways.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Charlie has no confidence. He wallows and he's miserable, but Donald is like falsely optimistic. He's always happy. He's always excited, but it's like to a fault because he's way too naive.
Yeah.
I used a clip that you'll you would have heard already of Donald's pitch of his serial killer movie to Charlie. And it just so perfectly illustrates their dynamic. I mean, Charlie wants wants nothing but Donald to just be quiet, but he also wants to shoot down his dreams, because if he becomes a success, that's just going to depress Charlie more.
Yeah.
And, you know, the movie is pretty much about Charlie. He's the main character, but, you know, Donald just seems to pop up at the worst times just to take the wind right out of his sails. it's just a complete joy to watch, and Nicolas Cage does such an amazing job at it.
He really does, and he, I believe he earned an Oscar nomination for it. Well deserved.
Yes, he did.
And it's like a virtuoso performance, really. And you're right, it's like there's such an energy on the screen when the two of them are together.
Right.
You know, the combination of special effects and camera trickery and Nicolas Cage playing these two very different types of brothers, it's incredible. I completely agree. And I don't know what has happened with Nicolas Cage ever since.
I know. It's just I mean, I can't imagine what this new Left Behind movie is going to be like.
Where, oh, yeah.
I mean, it's going to be – I think it's going to be insane.
Can you, refresh on what exactly that is?
What's that?
Can you refresh my memory on what that is?
It's based on those what's the guy's name? I don't remember the guy's name, but it's a Rapture movie.
Oh, boy.
Where a bunch of people get raptured, and he plays like the pilot in a plane where a bunch of people on the plane have been raptured, and most of the movie he spends on the plane, I believe.
Okay.
And even the trailer, you just like... You know, why is he acting at, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, he's like at a 17.
Yeah, that's what he's become guilty of doing.
Yep.
And I guess he played his card too many times, playing the same type of role, the same type of kind of bug-eyed, you know, over the top, like you said, pitched to a 17 type of character in all these movies. I guess the last successful thing he's been a part of is the Ghost Rider franchise, and
the
even that
one
is...
was. I mean, it's Ghost Rider, so it's inherently ridiculous.
Sure, sure, of course.
The second Ghost Rider movie was like, what the hell is going on? Like, you're Nicolas Cage, for God's sake. You have an Oscar. You've been nominated several times.
Wildly talented.
Yeah, but. This one was one of his high points. So.
Absolutely. Very good choice. So moving along to my number three pick. I don't have too much to say, unfortunately, about the actual performers themselves, but this is actually the first one I thought of when I thought of this kind of dual role.
Okay.
And probably the reason I thought of it was because I automatically started thinking of movies I love. And this, again, it's one of these movies and it's one of these franchises where several actors are playing multiple people at once. But I've honed in on one specific one, and that would be Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future 3. And actually, you could also lump in Leah Thompson as well, playing Marty and Seamus McFly.
Okay.
When Michael J. Fox goes back in time to the Old West.
Well, you know me. I could talk about Back to the Future for hours, so.
Well, you may have to.
Yep.
Well, I mean, again, the only reason I have it at number three is because I love Michael J. Fox. I love the Back to the Future franchise. I really, really like Back to the Future 3. I probably like it just a smidge behind the original one.
Oh, I agree. I love Back to the Future 3.
It's just so fun. It's so fun. There's nothing... It's relaxed. There's nothing hard or challenging about it. As much as I like Back to the Future 2, I feel like a lot is going on in Back to the Future 2.
Oh, it is. It's a little bloated, but...
A little bloated. A little bit, you know, here and there and everywhere. But
right.
I love the third one, and... It was fun seeing Michael J. Fox kind of take on this, you know, Irish-born great-great-grandfather of Marty McFly, and, you know, kind of have the exaggerated red hair and the little red beard, and, you know, he inflected, you know, of course, a ridiculous little Irish accent, but it was just like a welcome surprise as a kid and even now to see him and Leah Thompson pop up in these small little meaningless roles, but they're fun, and it was, like I said, it was the first thing I thought of.
Right, and unlike when, you know, Michael J. Fox is in, like, the old makeup in the second movie and stuff like that, you know it's Michael J. Fox. He's kind of hidden in this role. Like,
yeah,
you know it's
him. Yeah,
it took
a little while.
You know it's him, but with the makeup and how, like, breathy his voice sounds and stuff like that, it's a little higher register and things like that. He does a really nice job, you know, disappearing behind that to really make him a new character, much less so for Leah Thompson, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
she
has the accent, but she's just Leah Thompson with an accent. Go ahead.
Oh, one thing you were saying about the old age makeup. Sometimes when you do that, when you're playing another character, you can lose the character.
Yeah.
In this instance, even with the accent, even with the red hair and the little red goatee, whatever he had going, you know, you could definitely feel like this was Marty McFly's direct descendant.
Yes, definitely.
You know, and I like that part of it. It was almost a little magical because he looked enough like him that it definitely could have been a relative, and he had the same kind of body type, obviously, and stature, and I just thought it was really cool.
Definitely.
You know? And so that's why it would be my number three pick.
Well, it's kind of perfect that that's your number three pick.
Great.
Because my number three pick is Thomas F. Wilson in Back to the Future 2.
It cost me $300!
Would you shut up about the car?
And yet another thing, how do you know where I live?
Let's just say we're related, Biff. And that being the case, I got a little present for you. Something that'll make you rich. You want to be rich, don't you?
Oh, yeah, sure, right. That's rich. You're going to make me rich?
You see, this book tells the future. It tells the results of every major sports event till the end of the century. Football, baseball, horse races, boxing. The information in here is worth millions, and I'm giving it to you.
Well, it's very nice. Thank you very much. Now, why don't you make like a tree and get out of here?
It's leave, you idiot. Make like a tree and leave. You sound like a damn fool when you say it wrong.
All right, then, leave and take your book with you.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I picked, you know, because I'm like, multiple thing. It has to be, I have to have Back to the Future in here somewhere. Obviously.
Oh, of course.
And, you know, because Michael J. Fox plays so many roles, Leah Thompson plays so many roles, Crispin Glover plays so many roles.
Mm-hmm.
But in Back to the Future 2, when I calculated it, Biff plays 5 roles.
Really?
Because he plays 1985 Biff.
Mm-hmm.
He plays old 2015 Biff.
Right.
He plays 2015 Griff.
Yeah.
He plays the alternate 1985 Biff.
Right.
And then he plays the 1955 young Biff.
Oh, wow.
And they're all so...
I totally forgot about Griff. I mean, duh. I forgot about Griff.
And all 5 performances... And my thing is, I was almost going to cheat and say 2 and 3 so I can add Buford Mad Dog Tannen
right,
to the mix.
Right, right.
Because I probably like that one better than any of these 5.
Yeah, but it's so impressive. This
right, in one movie, the fact... I mean, Biff acts more than almost anybody in this whole movie because his villain character is a part of almost everything that happens at one level or another.
Yep.
And I would probably have to say, well, my favorite is always the 1955 young Biff. He is so great. Oh.
So great, so perfectly stereotypical.
Right, and the fact that he can play that role and then Griff in 2015, who's the same age, and be so infinitely different from each other.
Yeah.
Just how they talk, how they move. Even though they're both villains, they're both bullies, They mm-hmm. both have three people in his gang. You know, they're supposed to be the same person, but as a character, they could not be more different.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could go through each of the five, but most everybody has seen Back to the Future 2.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, as you go through the movie and you see Thomas F. Wilson go from the, you know, in order of what I had said with those five.
Right.
You're just like, wow, this guy is really talented.
Really talented. I really love your pick. It's really inspired, Kev. Because even though going through my mind, Back to the Future, love the movie, probably one of my favorite of all time. And I thought of him, but not until you really broke it down.
Well,
especially in the second movie, you're right. And I'm going through my mind the kind of kaleidoscope of different characters and different types of villainry he offers. It's a great choice,
right? And when thinking of multiple, I thought of Back to the Future, and my first thought was Michael J. Fox, and I thought of three, and I was like, that's good. But then I went back to think of two, and I'm like, well, he plays Marty, he plays old Marty, and he plays Marty Jr., and he plays Marlene. So he has a lot too, but I'm like, I don't think he's quite as good as Biff, as Thomas F. Wilson is.
What my number three choice is showing, and what your number three choice is showing, is just how insanely magical Back to the Future is anyway. Anyone involved with the movie and the undeniable talents of Michael J. Fox and Thomas Wilson just put to great use here.
Right.
My number two pick would be a particular actor who is one of my faves. He can do drama, he can do comedy. And when thinking about him and the different movies that he's played multiple roles in, I kind of honed in on this one. It's a drama, well, with some comedic undertones, but it's basically a drama. It's from 1993, and it would be Kevin Kline in Dave.
Very, very good choice. I had never even thought of it.
Well, that's how I felt when you said Sam Rockwell.
Right.
And I was like, duh.
No, like, I think that probably, that this, well, I'll let you talk, but I probably would have substituted this movie with Moon if I had thought of it.
Right. It's a little bit out there, I know.
Yeah.
But just from what I remember of the movie, I haven't seen it in a long time, but...
Oh, I know this movie by heart, so I'll be able to help you.
Oh, perfect. You can just take over the reins. I mean, I think that he plays President of the United States, kind of an a-hole, who I believe he has a major stroke. And Kevin Kline also plays a man named Dave, who has been kind of hired to step in as the president, kind of visually, right? Like, so that the president, like the president has to be, like, not shown from the public, right, Kevin? Like, not shown from the public for certain things?
Well, what it is that Dave is hired
by the government.
By the government, to impersonate the president, but before he has the stroke.
But yeah, right. He has the job already.
Right, just to wave and, you know, as a security thing to get out of a event.
Right.
And then once he has the once the president has the stroke, mm-hmm. the Frank Langella and Kevin Dunn are the two actors. I think it's one's the chief of staff. I think Frank Langella is the chief of staff, and I think Kevin Dunn plays the press secretary or something like that.
Something like that, okay.
And it's their idea of, let's just keep them there.
Yeah, Frank Langella was the chief of staff, and Kevin Dunn was the communications director. I just looked it up.
Which today is probably the press secretary.
Right. Communications director.
Right.
And, you know, the first lady is played by Sigourney Weaver.
Yep.
She really can't stand her husband, the president. She only is around him when she absolutely has to be. And, you know, she is kept in the dark,
right,
much like most everybody else, about that Dave is actually the president. And it's just such an interesting movie to watch. And the movie itself is so good. And Kevin Kline, as always, is so good. And that he can kind of play Dave stepping into the role with this kind of hold
amazement
on.
Almost.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The amazement of what he's been thrown into.
Yep.
Again, it's such a unique film. It's smart, and Kevin Kline does an amazing job.
And one of the most important things about this dual role is that, mm-hmm. 98% of the role is Dave. He only plays the president. How long do you see him as the president?
Not much at all.
45 seconds?
Most of the time, he's in a coma.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of meet him at when they first hire Dave. They have that "you're a very handsome man" joke.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, mm-hmm. Like, it's that scene where Kevin Kline has to pull off how unliked, how serious.
Cold, serious.
Right. And it has to linger in your head, that scene, the entire movie, because if it doesn't,
yep.
You don't understand why people are talking about how, a new lease on life the president has with all mm-hmm. the press and stuff like that. That makes no sense if you don't see that harsh contrast and hold that contrast in your memory, because you don't see it the rest of the movie.
I agree that everything hinges on that one scene. You're right. If they didn't nail that,
yeah.
It would be kind of different.
And the funny thing, there's another dynamic to it, is that when early on, when Dave is playing the president, he intimidates the president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not intimidates, imitates the president.
I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I didn't mean intimidates. He imitates the president.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see Dave, like, he's all, like, happy and in awe and stuff like that. And then he goes into his shtick, and you see his face drop. He gets serious.
Yeah.
He becomes rigid. So it's...
Well, there's so many layers. It's almost like one of those movie within a movie. It's an impersonation within an impersonation. You know what
exactly.
I mean? Like a ripple effect.
Right. No, that's a great one.
Yeah, thanks. That's why Dave is my number two, and now I'm eagerly anticipating your number two, Kev.
All right. So, oh boy, I think I'm going to throw you for a loop here.
Oh, God.
But we'll see.
I may go running for the hills.
So, my number two is from 1964.
And it's not Mary Poppins?
And it's not Mary Poppins.
Oh, let me think. Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Yep, it's Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove.
Hello? Hello, Dimitri. Listen, I can't hear too well. Do you suppose you could turn the music down just a little? Oh, that's much better. Yes. Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then... Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine. Now then, Dimitri, you know how we've always talked about the possibility of something going wrong with the bomb. The bomb, Dimitri. The hydrogen bomb. Well, now, what happened is one of our base commanders, he had a sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head. You know, just a little funny. And he went and did a silly thing. Well, I'll tell you what he did. He ordered his planes to attack your country. Well, let me finish, Dimitri. Let me finish, Dimitri. Well, listen, how do you think I feel about it? Can you imagine how I feel about it, Dimitri? Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello? Of course I like to speak to you. Of course I like to say hello. Not now, but any time, Dimitri. I'm just calling up to tell you something terrible has happened. It's a friendly call. Of course it's a friendly call. Listen, if it wasn't friendly, you probably wouldn't have even got it.
Okay.
Peter Sellers is like a genius of multiple roles.
Mm-hmm.
And in Doctor Strangelove, the three roles he plays...
it was only three?
Yeah, it was the Captain Mandrake, who's the Brit, who's mm-hmm. with the Colonel, I think, who is talking about the Russians, like, with fluoridation and their essences and fluids and all this kind of nonsense.
Okay.
I think it's a colonel. It might be a general who sets the whole plane on its course.
Okay.
So he plays Captain Mandrake, who's the Brit.
Okay.
He mm-hmm. plays the president.
Right.
And he plays Dr. Strangelove.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my favorite of those three is the president.
Okay.
And he plays President Muffley.
Mm-hmm.
I played the clip of him on the phone with the Russian president explaining the situation, and the way that Peter Sellers plays the president, how he's so ill-equipped to deal with the situation in front of him, it makes me laugh so hard, because he's trying to get a grip on the situation and calm everybody down, and it's all in the face of, like, nuclear annihilation, and he just seems so hopeless and helpless
mm-hmm.
that I just can't help but laugh at it, because it's a Kubrick movie. The man is the definition of a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And every one of those scenes where, like, he's talking with George C. Scott...
Mm-hmm.
And he keeps asking questions to the general, and the general, like, how George C. Scott looks at him, like, well, as you know, Mr. President, you know, he doesn't want to condescend to him because he's the president, but you know the general thinks the president's a doofus.
Yeah, completely.
So, you know, his performance as Captain Mandrake is very funny, because it's all reactions to the crazy, you know, general that sent the plane out to kill everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doctor Strangelove stuff is the over-the-top ridiculous, you know. So you can't help but laugh at that.
Oh, sure.
But the...
I mean, that's a vision I think of when I think of the movie.
Of course. And that's what most people think.
But I like that you chose the president.
I really like him.
Favorite of
the three. I like him overall for the whole movie, but out of those three... Every time he's playing the president, it makes me laugh so hard.
Definitely. I love your pick. Of course, all it's done now is make me want to go and re-rent it. I haven't seen it in a few years, but I remember it being so funny. And funny that it was funny and a Kubrick movie.
Right. I mean, I think when AFI did their comedy list, it was like 4 or 6, maybe. Like, it was really high.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is funny. And it's one of those... It's funny because it's so absurd, but it's not unrealistic.
It's almost like art imitating life in a warped way.
Yeah.
And Peter Sellers, another one, so talented, so funny. He easily morphs from one character to the next. I've seen him in comedies, and I've seen him in dramas. He's in a movie, I think, from 1979 called Being There.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, amazing. Blew me away. And there really isn't too much comedy to that role. He could do it all. And he's another one who kind of died well before he should have.
Oh, absolutely.
I really wish he would have been around longer to kind of wow us and other stuff.
Yeah, he easily could still be alive today. He'd be in his 80s, but...
Right. Well, that was a great choice indeed.
Okay.
Okay, so my number one is kind of strange, kind of unconventional. And I don't actually even know why I'm picking it as my number one. I think I'm picking it as my number one because it's one of the first ones that jumped to my mind. And I thought it was it's unique compared to the rest of our lists. So I'm actually going to go, oddly enough, because it's unique, with Army Hammer as the Winklevoss twins in 2010's The Social Network.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'm Cameron Winklevoss, and this is my brother, Ty.
And you're here because... either of you can answer.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I thought you were reading the letter.
I read the letter.
Well, we came up with an idea for a website called Harvard Connection. We've since changed the name to Connect You. And Mark Zuckerberg stole that idea.
I understand. And I'm asking what you want me to do about it.
Well, sir, in the Harvard Student Handbook, which is distributed to each freshman, under the heading Standards of Conduct in the Harvard Community, it says the college expects all students to be honest and forthcoming in their dealings with members in this community. Students are required to respect public and private ownership and instances of theft, misappropriation...
And...
Yes, sir.
Punch me in the face. Go ahead.
Or unauthorized use will result in disciplinary action, including a requirement to withdraw from the college.
You memorize that instead of doing what?
Oh, what my brother and I came here today to ask of you, respectfully,
sir,
of course, is it's against university rules to steal from another student, plain and simple.
You've spoken to your housemaster.
Yes, sir. And the housemaster made a recommendation to the ad board, but the ad board won't see us.
Have you tried dealing with the other student directly?
Mr. Zuckerberg hasn't been responding to any of our emails or phone calls for the last 2 weeks. He doesn't answer when we knock on his door at Kirkland, and the closest I've come to dealing with him face-to-face is when I saw him on the quad and chased him through Harvard Square.
You chased him?
I saw him, and I know he saw me. I went after him, and then he disappeared.
I don't see this as a university issue.
Of course this is a university issue. There's a code of ethics and an honor code, and he violated
them. You enter into a code of ethics with the university, not with each other.
I'm sorry, President Summers, but what you just said makes no sense to me at all.
Very interesting.
See? basically, the reason I'm going with that is because a couple of factors. One, no one had ever heard of Armie Hammer.
No. He came out of absolutely nowhere.
He came out of absolutely nowhere. And what he was able to do, both him and the, you know, tech wizards of the special effects team, to have him play these Winklevoss twins, they were able, he was able to be both extremely similar and yet different enough from each other that you could kind of distinguish the two twins from each other.
Yeah, like you have to almost, respect like what he must be thinking. Like, okay, which one am I playing in this scene? Okay,
right.
Now this is the reaction, and how am I going to change my performance? Just that tiny bit.
Notch, right? Whether it's a hairstyle or a flick of a facial reaction or the speed with which he's delivering a line. Exactly. I thought that was really masterfully done in a very serious movie, and yet it's a serious movie, but there's definitely humor in it, and
a lot of that humor comes from their frustration, their character's
exactly.
frustration.
Exactly, their joint frustration, but they both kind of dealt with it in different ways, and they both had different opinions of how to approach things.
Right.
As they were getting, you know, insight from other characters on what to do about, you know, the Mark Zuckerberg character just pulling the rug out from under them.
Right.
And I just thought that it was unique in that it's a recent movie, and that this actor that no one heard of came out of nowhere, was able to be so effective. You know,
and he definitely was.
Special effects or not, you know, I thought he nailed it. So even though it's probably it's a strange choice as number one, I thought I would be different in choosing it.
No, it is, but it's very, very interesting because it shows, you know, with my adaptation pick, you know,
right.
They're identical, but they're vastly different. So
right.
It's pretty easy for Nicolas Cage to say, okay, I'm playing Donald now. Okay, I'm playing Charlie now.
Right,
but,
right. I mean, he's excellent as both, but you're right. They're very different.
Yeah, they're two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
And the Winklevoss twins are like, you know, 97% equal.
Right.
Except that little 3% really distinguishes their two characters, and they are very different characters.
Yeah, that's basically why I chose it. I thought it was different.
Perfect.
Huh. And you're number one.
All right. Well, when I thought of this list, I mean, I feel like Eddie Murphy has to be represented because it's
He's
pretty much his legacy is multiple performance movies.
Yeah.
at a, more than anybody else, I think more than any actor almost ever, he is a multiple performance comedian.
Yep.
And I almost chose Bowfinger because I love that movie.
Well, that's right. You did love that.
And the differences between Kit Ramsey and Jif are infinitely different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to go with my classic choice, and that's Coming to America.
Mm-hmm.
You must be out of your goddamn mind. Joe Louis, the greatest boxer ever lived. I'll be with you boys in a minute. He was bad in Captain Clay. He bad in Sugar Ray. He bad in that. Who that? You, the new boy got. Mike Tyson look like a bulldog. He bad in him, too. He whip Mike Tyson's ass. He whip all their asses.
What about Rocky Marciano?
Oh, there they go. There they go. Every time I start talking about boxing, a white man got to pull Rocky Marciano out their ass. That's they one. Rocky Marciano. Let me tell you something once and for all. Rocky Marciano was good. But compared to Joe Louis, Rocky Marciano ain't shit.
He beat Joe Louis's ass.
That's right. He did whoop Joe Louis' ass. Joe Louis was 75 years old when he fought.
I don't know how old he was, but he got an ass whooped.
Joe Louis had come out of retirement to fight Rocky Marciano. The man was 76 years old. Joe Louis always lied about his age. He lied about his age all the time. One time, Frank Sinatra comes out here and sat down in this chair. And I said, Frank, you hang out with Joe Louis just between me and you. How old is Joe Louis? You know what Frank told me? He said, hey, Joe Louis 137 years old. 137 years old.
Oh, man, you ain't never meet no Frank Sinatra.
Fuck you! Fuck you and fuck you!
Who's next?
It's just, I've been watching Coming to America for almost 20 years, and I cannot stop laughing at that movie,
mm-hmm.
like, up till now. And I have to say, Arsenio Hall is almost as good as Eddie Murphy is, mm-hmm. playing the multiple roles. Like, it's, how did Arsenio Hall, like, disappear for so long after this?
Right.
Because he was so good, but...
Oh, see, I didn't even remember that he played a multiple role, too.
Yeah. I mean, if there's 50 roles in the movie,
mm-hmm.
probably 15 are played by Eddie Murphy and 12 are played by Arsenio Hall.
Right.
But, you know, with Eddie Murphy, you know, he obviously plays, you know, the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just... You know, that role has its own certain comedy and everything, but the little roles that he runs into, like, you know, the barber in the barbershop, the old Jewish guy in the barbershop,
mm-hmm.
the ridiculous jerry-curled singer at the Black Awareness Rally, you know, the lead singer of Sexual Chocolate.
And it's not gimmicky. They're all very funny.
It's one of those things where it's like, we want this scene to be funny, mm-hmm. and why would we trust somebody else when we have Eddie Murphy here?
Exactly.
It kind of falls into that. And this movie just shows how good he can be. I mean, a lot of people, you know, mention the Nutty Professor and the second Nutty Professor and how...
Yeah.
The difference with that is that, you know, all these people sit around a table and they interact with each other, which means the editing is weird because they very rarely show the same two people on screen at once.
Right.
Because Eddie Murphy's doing all, like, six people in one scene.
Mm-hmm.
But in Coming to America, he almost never interacts with himself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, very, like, in the barbershop, he does a little bit, but, like, not in any, it's not about that. It's about, you know, how the barbershop is before he gets there and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. It's just a movie that, on the surface, is one of the great 80s comedies.
Comedies, yeah.
But it's a perfect example of how good Eddie Murphy can do in comedies,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of people have forgotten in recent years.
I know. He's kind of gotten like a little bit of a rap. Was this his first breakout comedy hit? I'm trying to think of, because it was 88.
Well, I mean, he was already Eddie Murphy because of SNL.
Of course.
I can't say for sure 88. It seems late.
Seem late, yeah. I'm trying to...
He must have had a couple before that.
Right.
Because to get such a... lead role like that.
Right.
But yeah, so I had to choose one from him, and yeah. When I decided that, when I said, you know what, I think Coming to America has to beat out Bowfinger.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
I think it's a good choice. It's a good choice for you. I've heard you over the years talk effusively about Coming to America, and as these podcasts have been doing to me, now you make me want to see it again because, I mentioned to you the other day, it's been a while, and I'm in the mood to laugh at Eddie Murphy.
Right. And I just remembered he did the first two Beverly Hills Cop movies before that.
So. Ah, yes.
Yeah, so he was well established as a box office star already.
Right.
So that's my number one.
It's a great one.
All right. So I leave it to you to pick our next list.
All right. I am up to the task.
Okay. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. Do us a favor and go to our iTunes page for Kevin and JJ's Movie Mania podcast and leave us a review, or just head on over to our website, kevinandjjmovies.weebly.com. Look around, let us know what you think. We have a little forum there so you can leave some comments, whatever you'd like. Hope you enjoyed. I think next time we'll be doing another Deserted Island recording, so hope you enjoy that too. Thanks again, and have a good one.